And a good morning to everybody out there in podcast land. This is Tom at Tom Harris USA, episode number 44. Just wanted to give you guys a brief update on what's been going on. Now, this show is a little bit late going out. I'm hoping that it'll go out on the same day that I would normally post it, which is to say on the 19th. However, I have been having some problems with the site and with my ISP, like I've been trying to remind people. However, I do think that this morning my internet speed is up to snuff, so hopefully I'll be able to get the show up on time, more or less. I do want to say that as much as I've complained about bad customer service, I want to give kudos where kudos is due. And that is with my podcast provider, the people who actually host the podcast, which is Podbean, podbean.com. They caught a problem, or I caught a problem this past week, and it was Friday, I noticed, right after I uploaded the last show, that the site was down. My site was down, and because I've been having so much trouble with my connection in general and accessing things on the web and so forth, I think, okay, well, maybe it's me. But I tried later in the day, and when my speeds were actually, you know, somewhat close to normal, and it was still down. So I figured, okay, well, they're doing maintenance, whatever. Saturday morning, the site was still down. So I sent them an email to the support and said, hey, you know, my site is unavailable. Can you do something about it, please? Within 12 hours, they had the site back to normal. I mean, they hopped right on it. They emailed me back and they said, you know, there was a server problem. We caught it. Thanks for letting us know about it. So, you know, that is good customer service. There you go. You know, for every RCN out there who is doing crappy customer service, you've got someone else who's right on the ball. And I really, really appreciated that from them. So way to go, Podbean. Now I know that I'm in a minority here because most of my podcasting friends use different hosts other than Podbean. Most of them are using Libsyn, which is more expensive than Podbean, but I get a sense that they could be a little bit more reliable. I don't know. I've got a year or 2 years something that I've signed up with Podbean. So and so far, you know, I'll be honest, I'm perfectly happy with Podbean as a host. This is the first time that I've really had any trouble with their service. So way to go, Podbean. Hooray. So moving right along, the job hunt is still going on. I still don't have a job. And in fact, since the last show, I haven't even had a nibble or an interview or anything. I do have a few more resumes out there. That's ongoing, of course, and you have to expect that. But interesting thing that's happened this week is that I've started to get scam replies to my resume. And this happened last time, though, to a much lesser extent. Last time I did a job search at about, I've been now unemployed for 2 weeks, just a little bit over 2 weeks now. And I was just starting to get some nibbles from the agencies at this point. They were contacting me. Now, because the job market is depressed right now, and there aren't as many jobs out there, I haven't been getting those hits on my resume. But I am getting hits on my resume from scammers. And this is something to be aware of, and I thought I'd mention it on the show, is that you have these companies out there who have shitty jobs available, usually insurance sales, that, you know, commission, part-time contract work, that sort of thing. And they will randomly send out advertising to all of the people who have their resumes online in the hopes that you will fall for their bait. And I had one in particular that it was, I'm not going to mention the name of the company. They are a insurance company that is built like a pyramid scheme, kind of like Amway is. And in order to make money working for that company, you have to sign up with them. You have to pay for your own training. And I assume that this is kind of like what I had going on when I worked for George Washington Life back in 1983. Yes, I've sold insurance. I've done I've done almost everything. Twice if I like it. when I was selling insurance, I didn't have to pay for my own training, but I had to pay for my own testing, you know, because you had to take a course and study your insurance documents and so forth, and then you had to go and take a state insurance exam, and did that, and I got my insurance, state insurance license. You know, I had to pay for the test, but I didn't have to pay for my training. You know, that was something that the company provided. So anyway, this insurance company, they make you pay for your training, and you get your insurance license, and then you can't make any money for yourself unless you recruit other people. So this is your classic pyramid scheme. And if you go online and look up this company, again, I'm not going to mention who they are, you can find web page after web page after web page of people complaining about how they were duped into this at the promise of a good job with a good salary, and they ended up having to spend all this money out of pocket, and they still would not get leads from the company for the insurance. And the fact that they have leads tells me that's a sales job. I mean, it's not you know, just what they said, to servicing already existing accounts. You know, so it's a trick that they use to get people to come in. They promise them good money, and then they dupe them into spending a lot of their own money, which they probably can't afford, to get training. And that money goes to the company. So there are others out there who do stuff like that, and I've noticed a big increase in that now. And maybe they're playing on the desperation of people who are job hunting, because I know there's a lot of people out there who don't have benefits. I'm lucky enough, or have prepared well enough, I suppose, that I have unemployment insurance, that I can coast a little bit. And the last time I did a job hunt, I didn't have that. And I would have been a lot more likely to grab onto something like this. Because last time I never filed for unemployment. I figured, okay, well, you know, I didn't think, you know, that it would be a problem, and it wasn't. But with the economy being what it is, it's a little bit more difficult to do right now. So anyway, so that's the news from the job market. Not much going on this week. Tomorrow, Pete and I are going to go out canoeing, which is going to be a lot of fun, and we've done that before. We did it last fall a couple of times. And, we didn't. Pete and I went canoeing once last year, and I went canoeing another time with my best friend Paul, who you folks might remember from my shows about the Hadrian's Wall Path. But we're going to go down to the Fox River, which is about a 2-hour, 90-minute drive from here. We're going to go canoeing tomorrow, so that'll be good. It looks like the weather's going to be really nice. I called the place, and they said the river is really nice right now. So that ought to be fun. The thing to see right now, and this is one of the things I'm really looking forward to, is the autumn leaves, because autumn really has come here in Chicago. Now, I live about a block away from Lake Michigan, and if you go down towards the lake, you'll get to a park, which is actually a fairly long park. It kind of stretches along the lakefront for a few miles. And it's the area of it that's near me is called Loyola Park. And it's called Loyola Park because it's right by Loyola University. I'm very near Loyola University's main campus. That's just like half a mile from here. Anyway, down by the lake now, the trees are all changing, and the leaves are just gold and red and orange, and it's just absolutely gorgeous down there. And I'm assuming that a little bit further south, it's going to be the same, because the Fox River is actually, like I said, it's a couple hours south of here. It's sort of southwest of here. And I'm hoping that the foliage will be really, really nice down there. Weather's been very pleasant lately. This week is going to be in the 60s all week, which is fantastic, and it's great weather to go canoeing, I think. The only problem is this place is that you have to call ahead and arrange for transportation, because what they do is they take you to the beginning of the river course, and in this case, it's a 12-mile course along the Fox River. So you have to call and you have to reserve a spot, because they have a car or a van, or and I think the last time we were there was a school bus full of people, and it hauls a trailer that has all the canoes on it. So they take you to the beginning of where you set off on your canoe trip, which is 12 miles upriver, which is probably 15 miles or 20 miles along the road, because obviously the highway doesn't go right along the river. And then you launch from there, and then you can kind of take your time coming back, and then you finish at the place where you actually started before they drove you up to the beginning of the river. And that's the opposite of what it was when Paul and I canoed, because when Paul was here last year, we decided to go on a canoe trip, and we went on a canoe trip up in Wisconsin, up in the sort of northwest area of Wisconsin. Not really far north, but it was an area near the Kickapoo River is the name of it. And that was quite a good trip as well. Now, that was a little bit more challenging than what we're going to be doing tomorrow. Tomorrow is going to be a nice, easy float downriver. We won't have to do a lot of rapids and that sort of thing, because the river is a very gentle river. The Fox River is not a very difficult river. Very easy canoeing. The Kickapoo River is a little bit more of a challenge, because it has a lot of rapids and a lot of currents that could become very dangerous if you don't know what you're doing. And I don't think that Pete is quite ready for that yet, because this will only be the second time he's ever been canoeing in his life. But I'm hoping that it'll be a nice trip, and I'm looking forward to going down there. Oh, anyway, what I was saying before, the reason why it's different is that when Paul and I went up on the Kickapoo River, we actually started at the launch point. We started right from the place where you rent the canoe. They don't take you anywhere. And then it's up to you to find the place where you end. And they tell you where it is. They give you a marker that you have to look for, and you find the marker, and that's where you have to land the canoe. But I do prefer it the other way, I think. It makes it easier, because the place where you rent the canoes is much easier to find. And when you're coming back from it, and then you don't have to take a long bus ride back. When we did the Kickapoo River, we actually had to wait a while for the bus to arrive. Actually, it was a van, I think, that drove us back to the beginning point where we started. So I actually prefer it that way. And I really, really would like to go with Pete along the Kickapoo River once he has a little bit more experience under his belt and is able to navigate a canoe a little bit more confidently. He's really, really quick at picking this stuff up. And I think he really actually has a natural talent for this. But he just doesn't have a lot of experience doing this. So anyway, that's what we're doing tomorrow. And that's one of the advantages of being unemployed, is that we can do things on a weekday and go off and do stuff, and it won't be so crowded because it won't be the weekend. Speaking of going out and doing things, Pete and I went last night to go see Where the Wild Things Are, and a lot of you have probably not seen this movie yet, because I think it just came out, so I'm not going to say too much about it, other than to say I actually enjoyed it. It was better than I thought it was going to be. I thought it was going to be kind of lame. And it definitely had a lot of good points to it. So if you haven't seen Where the Wild Things Are, I'd go have a look at it. Now, if you've just read the book, the original book, which is like 12 pages long, I think I read it was 388 words was the original book. And the book is by Maurice Sendak, by the way, who also was one of the producers of the movie. They didn't adapt that story directly. What they did is they adapted this book that Maurice Sendak had written that was a novelization. It was a longer work. And it was a lot more thematically complex. So don't expect this 12-page children's story stretched out to 12 hours. There's a lot more to it than that. And so it is interesting. They did a really nice job on the special effects. Obviously, they had to use people wearing big suits But the movie was fun, and I'm going to say, you know, you should go see that. So anyway, that's all about all I have to say on Where the Wild Things Are. But it was certainly better than Inglourious Basterds. Anyway, I have an email here, and I have an email from Richard. And we are continuing, I think, a little bit of our music discussion that we've been having on the show. Richard being one of a good friend from a long time ago. And Richard had this to say, haha, caught the latest podcast and figured I should drop a note. Seeing as I'm a fan of the Straubs and hadn't really thought of them in a while. Now, if you folks recall, last episode, I talked a little bit about a band called the Straubs, and I actually had a little bit of their music on the show for review purposes only, mind you. Now, Richard may or may not have been the person who introduced me to Straubs to begin with. Not really sure about that. But Richard was certainly one of those people who influenced me musically, and maybe not in ways that are immediately obvious, but a lot of my musical taste, I think, you know, this is probably true of everybody, is that everybody's musical tastes are influenced by various people. And I'm sure that if you were to go back and think about it, you can probably name the people who were the most influential on you personally, as far as music goes. Now, for me, certainly my brother Tim, who I had to share a bedroom with for three or four years back when we were teenagers, he was certainly, well, back when I was a teenager, not necessarily him. And yeah, I think I got a lot of my musical taste from my siblings. And then when we were teenagers, I think our musical taste started to kind of drift apart. And Richard, I would say, was probably another one of those key people because he got me interested in a lot of stuff that I hadn't been listening to before. He got me interested in listening to R.E.M. I know he's probably kicking himself for doing that now. R.E.M., The Waterboys, there were the other bands too, and I'm trying to think of them. But he, you know, he actually introduced me to a number of different of bands. Echo and the Bunnymen was another one. I still like them. I still listen to them. Then there was Michael Griffin, who was a good friend of ours, who mutual friend of mine and Richard's, who started me listening to industrial music, and through that I got into some other stuff that's sort of tangential to industrial music, goth music, and noise, and so forth. So Michael was very influential. On another side, I have my friend Peter in Atlanta. Oh, God, no, I have to do it. The disclaimer, the warning, the show contains a mention of Peter in Atlanta. You know, I don't even know if Peter's even listening to the show. I hope he is, but I don't know if he is. I have about, you know, 20 something people who subscribe to the show, and I don't know who they all are, so who knows. Anyway, so those are all people who have been very influential on the music that I listen to. And also, having done my own radio show, I have tried to spread the music that I listen to around and get other people who are interested in too. Anyway, I'm getting way away from this email here. I'm turning into Chris Rudin. So going back, okay, but just start from the beginning. Caught the latest podcast and figured I should drop a note. Seeing as I'm a fan of the Straubs and hadn't really thought of them in a while, as influential as they were to me, they are records that I rarely play these days, though I remain loath to part with them. Speaking of influence, you may recall that Just Another Hangman, that's a song that Richard wrote that I'm very fond of, owes rather a lot to Dave Cousins, and particularly the Hangman and the Papist, a song that's on one of the Straubs album. You neglected to mention that the Straubs were something of a launching pad for other British artists, most notably Sandy Denny, who was England's finest female singer and songwriter. Also, Rick Wakeman, who went on to many prog rock heart attacks. I think he's talking here of War of the Worlds and that ilk. I did neglect to mention that. And there's actually a lot of cross-pollination going on. I might have mentioned this last time, between the Straubs and other bands. And Rick Wakeman, of course, certainly, he was connected with Yes. Anderson, Bruford, Wakeman, and Howe. He did a lot of solo stuff, which is various levels of quality of stuff. He did this very bloated, overblown version of The War of the Worlds, which I mentioned earlier, that he did with Justin Hayward of the Moody Blues. That was, I mean, there's some good stuff on there, but it's generally not what I would call a fantastic album. I think it would be a good illustration of the excesses of progressive rock of that era. Interesting to note that while the Straubs are considered part of the British folk revival, they actually began life as devotees of American bluegrass, hence their original name, the Strawberry Hill Boys. It was Sandy Denny who really pushed them into English trad material, being a dab hand at it herself. The one album they made together, All Our Own Work, is really very much infused with Sandy Denny's vision. After the one album, Sandy made the historic jump to joining Fairport Convention. Yeah, we'll talk about them in a bit. Two more trad folk albums followed, whose titles escape me. I have them as a double pack LP called, unimaginatively, The Early Straubs. Recorded in Germany, they are perhaps my favorite, quick-witted, sparse, and eager. With the addition of Rick Wakeman at Hudson and Ford, they became more of the band as we think of them today. Some of that early Straub stuff doesn't appeal to me for some reason. I'm not really sure why that is. As to why their work is sometimes inconsistent on the best of you referred to, incidentally, the best of I referred to is called Halcyon Days, just for reference sake. Remember that Dave Cousins, the guiding voice of the band, suffered rather badly from depression, causing him to withdraw from the band at times and for his songwriting to suffer. But the best of Cousins' writing is the best of the band's output. I recommend the first five albums and Cousins' solo LP 2 weeks last summer, which is fabulous. After that, it gets hit or miss. Yeah, I'll up to that. I don't know if I want to blame depression on the erratic output. And I had an email from Mystery Woman. And she hadn't listened to the show. And she was saying that how she thinks a lot of it has to do with marketing and that sort of thing. And I think she's right there. But keeping in mind that the prog rock bands tended not to have this deluge of marketing, I don't know how big of an influence that was. But I don't know if I'm going to blame that on depression. I mean, I suffer from depression myself. It's something that I've talked about on the show. And I think that's true of a lot of artistic people. And sometimes people can use it as a launching point for various projects. But, yeah, I don't know if I want to blame it on that. Maybe, you know, part of it is that they were often doing this themed material. And I think Hero and Heroine is a good example of that, where they kind of have this overblown theme. And I guess that raises another point, too. Now, the song that I played in the last show, which is an excerpt from the song Midnight Sun, that was off the album Heroine, Heroine. And I think that's Heroine, Heroine is a really good example of how sporadic the quality in one of these concept albums can be. Because taken individually, some of these songs are really fantastic. But if you put them all together, they're somehow less memorable, if you know what I'm saying. And I think that is maybe the point that I was trying to make last time. You know, sometimes I'm not so good at making the point thing. And I don't really have anything against the whole idea of doing concept albums. But when done badly, they can really be tedious. I think that's the easiest way to put it. Now, sometimes people have done them really well. If you listen to the trilogy of Jethro Tull albums, which starts with Minstrel in the Gallery. It's Minstrel in the Gallery, Songs from the Wood, and Heavy Horses. They do, the three of them, have a nice cohesive theme. And they kind of riff on the same musical ideas. And I think a lot of people, myself included, think of those as the best Jethro Tull albums, or at least the best little period of Jethro Tull, who we'll talk more about in a sec. Moving on with the email, I'll allow Steel Eye Span as an example of the Brit folk rock scare, but Jethro Tull and Pentangle not so much. In spite of Burt Jansch, Pentangle has always seemed more of a jazz troupe than a folk band. Yeah, I kind of agree there. admittedly a very eccentric English jazz troupe. Jethro Tull is a rock band, whatever they picked up from Roy Harper and the like. And I like old Ian Anderson, don't get me wrong. Actually, the reason why I mention Jethro Tull as part of this movement is because Ian Anderson himself considers them and that an influence on Jethro Tull. And there's actually some very, very good Ian Anderson interviews that are available, and a lot of these are on YouTube, so I definitely would recommend. I have enormous respect for Ian Anderson as a human being and as a musician. Now, a lot of the stuff he's putting out today is kind of crap. I hate to say it, but that's true, Ian. Not that Ian Anderson is listening to my show. But he actually said that he is influenced by the English rock scare, as you put it. Now, see, Richard really has a way of putting things. Richard, you need to get your own podcast. You really do. And there was a lot of back and forth between Jethro Tull and other bands, and especially Fairport Convention, which we're about to talk about. Not forgetting that there is a direct link, because Dave Maddox of Fairport Convention was the drummer for Jethro Tull for about 5 minutes back in 1992. I was surprised you didn't mention Fairport, who pretty much started the English folk rock scare and gave us Sandy Denny, Richard Thompson, Dave Swarbrick, and little old me in a roundabout way. The reason why I didn't mention Fairport Convention is because my mind went blank and I couldn't think of their name. And I do have a couple other albums. Love the band. I actually know Dave Swarbrick from some of the other stuff he did that had nothing to do with Fairport Convention. But I do like Fairport Convention, and that tied in a lot with some of the Celtic stuff that I was listening to in the mid-80s, and probably about the time when you and I were hanging out a lot together. I was going up to Tampa and so forth for these Celtic music concerts, which has nothing to do with rock and roll, but it was something that I really was very interested in for a while. Which is not to say that I'm not still interested in Celtic music, because I am. But there was this period of time between about 1984 and 1986 when I was very enthusiastic about it and was going to all sorts of concerts. Probably the first concerts that I ever went to by myself. And in fact, I've been to very few live concerts. I think I've talked about that. The only thing that you could really call rock and roll that I've ever been to a concert of prior to the last couple of years was Skinny Puppy, which is kind of a completely different category. Anyway, Richard goes on about some other stuff, which I'm not going to talk about. But isn't really, really interesting rehashing all of this stuff, because there is a lot of cross-pollination going on. And even though there may not have been a lot of direct links between these bands, there was certainly a lot of influences being shared between these bands. And you can say that, you know, Jethro Tull is to the English folk scare what Led Zeppelin is to black blues music. Not forgetting, of course, that Jethro Tull and Led Zeppelin actually influenced each other as well. That's another interesting thing, is that they shared a studio. So they actually, there was some back and forth influence going on there as well. I think if you go to the early work of both bands, there was a lot of the subbluesy, jazzy thing going on, and they were a lot more similar at that point than they were different. Now, obviously, Jethro Tull went one direction, Led Zeppelin went a completely different direction, and the two can't really be compared in what they ultimately became. Obviously, Jethro Tull is still out there. Led Zeppelin isn't. But they, of course, have evolved in a very different direction from what their very early albums, like Stand Up, or This Was, for that matter, their very first album. And, you know, it's very different from anything like Led Zeppelin did. And now I feel like I'm just babbling. Maybe it's time to wrap up the show. If you have any email, comments, questions, whatever, anything you'd like to hear me talk about on the show, please feel free to contact the show. The email address is tom@tomharrisusa.com. You can also contact me on the Facebook and the Tom Harris USA podcast Facebook group. Or if you are a Facebook friend of mine, you can email me directly. So I'm going to go ahead and sign off for now, and I'll see you next time. This is Tom at Tom Harris USA. Signing off. See you next time.